Find something that is difficult, arcane, and that other attorneys don't know how or don't like to do, and you'll always have work.
Welcome to the California Appellate Podcast, a discussion of timely trial tips and the latest cases and news coming from the California Court of Appeal and the California Supreme Court. And now your hosts, Tim Cole and Jeff Lewis.
Welcome, everyone. I am Jeff Lewis.
And I'm Tim Kowal. The California Appellate Law Podcast is a resource for trial and appellate attorneys. Both Jeff and I are appellate specialists, but we also split our time about evenly in the trial court as well. And in each episode of the podcast, we try to bring our audience of trial attorneys and appellate attorneys some legal news and insights they can use in their practice.
And a quick thank you to CaseText, our podcast sponsor. CaseText is a legal research tool that harnesses AI and a lightning-fast interface to help lawyers find case authority fast. I've been a subscriber since 2019, and I highly endorse the service. Listeners of the podcast will receive a 25% lifetime discount available to them if they sign up at casetext.com/calp. That's casetext.com/CALP.
Now, Jeff, as appellate attorneys, at about the time you and I are preparing to close our doors and turn off our phones and spend many quiet hours alone with the appellate record, there are other attorneys out there doing much more exciting things. I'm talking about judgment enforcement. I've done only a little bit of collection work myself, but in preparing for doing that work, I've spent many entertaining hours online reading about exotic things like sheriff auctions and till taps, and even how you can send the sheriff to a debtor's home to take their cash, cars, valuables, or even, for the sake of leverage, his beloved little pet dog. Judgment enforcement and defense against judgment enforcement are very important to litigants facing an appeal, but it kind of sits in that twilight space in between the trial and the appeal. So most trial and appellate attorneys don't know a lot about judgment enforcement and defense of judgment enforcement. So we thought that today our audience might enjoy hearing from a specialist in the area of judgment enforcement and defense. And the judgment enforcement attorney on my speed dial is Joseph Chora. Joseph is a judgment enforcement attorney whose practice focuses exclusively on the enforcement of judgments, not only in California, but also nationally and internationally. In addition to enforcing judgments, Joseph works with both trial and appellate attorneys with sensitive investigations that need the confidentiality of a law office and also the technical knowledge of a private investigation firm. So, Joseph Chora, welcome to the podcast.
Happy to be here. Thank you, Tim. Thank you, Jeff.
Now, Joseph, years ago, I listened to a collection attorney suggest using a writ of execution to have the sheriff visit the debtor's house. And like I mentioned earlier, take his beloved pet for the sake of leverage, because often at that point, the debtor will just get out his checkbook and start writing the check to the creditor. Does that sort of thing really happen in your practice enforcing judgments?
Well, first of all, let me just be clear that anytime assets, any property that's taken, it's taken for the financial value, not for leverage. That would be an improper purpose, and that would be a great way to have your levy undone. So if a pet were valuable, say a show dog or a rare bird, then that would make sense. But if you have a mutt that's 10 years old near the end of his life, no real value other than sentimental, the judge would probably put a kibosh on that.
Oh, I see. So if you start going through the house and pointing to family portraits on the wall and start taking those, that would be only for sentimental value and for leverage and not a proper purpose of judgment enforcement.
Exactly right. And there are exemptions that exempt normal, typical household goods. Fine art, whether or not it has sentimental value that has real value to it, is always available for seizure.
Okay, interesting. Well, that's an important nuance that was not related when I watched that in a video by another judgment enforcement attorney years ago. I wonder if you, nonetheless, you must have some interesting stories from your practice in judgment enforcement and defense. I wonder if you could tell us one.
Sure. I'll tell you an urban legend that my firm may or may not have been involved with. Small judgment, about $75,000. The lead attorney decided to examine the debtor. And during our discovery, we discovered that the debtor had a girlfriend. And so the lead attorney decided it might be beneficial if we examined the wife, the girlfriend, and the husband all on the same day. Let's just say that those examinations never took place. Checkbook came out and the $75,000 was satisfied.
Now that's very clever. So that's So obviously the debtor got service of a copy of those judgment debtor, third-party judgment debtor examinations.
The debtor must be notified of everything that's filed, whether or not it involves them directly.
Yeah. Well, and that's, and obviously that was done partly for leverage, but ostensibly they had, they may have some useful information as well. So it was still a proper purpose.
Certainly.
Leverage was just a bonus.
Yes.
Got it.
Another example, if you're interested, is a little more technical. There was a debtor, it was a bicycle company, and they had a large judgment, $600,000, $700,000 against them. They had been around for 30 years. They had developed intellectual property. They went into bankruptcy, but they created a shadow corporation in which they transferred all their assets except for the intellectual property. And so the leverage that we were able to put on them was, we're going to sell your intellectual property for $1 and the creditor will buy it and you will forever be without your intellectual property, or you can settle this judgment. They ended up settling for about 125% of the judgment.
Wow.
Because the alternative would be to lose their IP.
Yeah. The golden goose. Interesting. Yeah.
Well, I can't ask the question that artists get asked and writers and things, how do you come up with these, with your ideas? But is there a network of judgment enforcement attorneys? Where do you get these ideas to put leverage? Are these original ideas, or are they kind of industry secrets?
I would say about half and half. We have 7 lawyers at our firm, and there is nothing better in the world. And maybe I'm outing myself as a dinosaur, but remote work has no place in my firm. There's nothing better than 2 attorneys staring each other in the eye and talking about a case. That synergy, that spontaneous generation of ideas is so valuable when you have to be creative.
Tell us more about how you got into developing a specialty doing collection work. Have you always done collection work, or did you start out as a business litigation attorney or some other sort?
I've always done collection work. When I finished law school, I didn't know a thing. Like most of us.
Like all of us, yeah.
Right? And I thought, I'm going to do everything. I'm going to do family law, commercial law, environment, everything I could do so that anybody who came to me, I could take care of their case.
You're a door attorney, as they call it. You take on any client who walks in the door.
A toaster, whatever pops up. And I was networking with other attorneys, and a senior told me, that's a stupid idea. Don't do that. He said, find something that is difficult, arcane, and that other attorneys don't know how or don't like to do, and you'll always have work. And I thought, okay, I could do that. And so I was going to do pre-judgment work, like pre-judgment writs of attachment, writs of possession. And then I ran into my now partner who was already doing collections, and it was a match made in heaven. As they say, the rest is history.
Yeah, pre-judgment, writs of attachment, that would be highly specialized. So this is so you branched out a little bit from that. Well, very interesting. And then, you know, I do note that there are only 11 legal specialty areas that are recognized by the state bar. And as you mentioned, judgment enforcement is a specialized and arcane area of law, but it's not one of the recognized specialty areas in which you can certify or get a certified license from the state bar. Should it be an area of legal specialty that the state bar should recognize, in your opinion?
You know what? I think it should be, but I'm okay that it's not. It makes me more of a specialist that there are no titles. It's kind of just me. There is a specialty, and it's called creditor's rights, but it specifically is slanted toward bankruptcy.
I see. Does much of your work bleed into the bankruptcy sphere?
Oftentimes. Typically, the life cycle for a case for us is to evaluate the judgment, determine if the debtor has money and then, or assets, I should say. And so if we're pursuing people who have the assets to pay and they want relief, they typically reach toward an appeal bond or bankruptcy. So all our cases from the outset are prepared for those 2 eventualities.
And we'll talk a little bit more about appeal bonds later. I wanted to ask you if you'd tell us just a little bit about your national and international practice. Obviously, some debtors will skip town and go across state lines, and so domestication of California judgments in other states may be necessary. Tell us a little bit about that aspect of your practice.
So I'm a minimalist. If I don't have to file a lawsuit, I would much prefer to take care of things via motion. And I recommend that if a person's major nexus of assets is in a different state, that you hire an attorney in that local state. Typically, my multi-state enforcement is either when their assets are concentrated in California and they have smaller assets, satellite assets in different states, or they're just entirely spread out throughout the entire country. And it wouldn't matter who you worked with. I can't hear you, Tim.
Just a couple more questions about your, by way of introduction here. What is something that a lot of civil attorneys don't know about judgment enforcement, but should know about judgment enforcement?
I've got two big ones for you. Gold nuggets, if nothing else you can get from this interview and my presence here, is one, if you have a judgment against someone and they transfer an asset, you don't have to file another lawsuit. You don't have to file a fraudulent transfer action. You can just levy on the asset transfer.
You can just levy on. So instead of having to file a separate judgment enforcement complaint, what is the process of levying on the action? Is it through the sheriff?
Yeah. So let's just say the debtor owns a house. It's in his name. You levy on it. You go through the process. You sell the house. Scenario two, before you're able to get a hold of the debtor, he transfers the asset, the house, to his 17-year-old son. Rather than filing a fraudulent transfer action to unwind that transfer, you simply levy on the house in the name of the son, and you unwind the transfer via motion through the levy process.
Wow. So that that short circuits a lot of unneeded civil procedure, I guess.
I mean, lawsuits, discovery, a skill. The debtor's number one defense is delay. And if you have a multimillionaire defendant, $300,000 buys a lot of delay.
There must still be some due process that the son would have in that scenario. Could he file objections? How could he still delay that process of the of levying on the fraudulently transferred asset?
Anytime you levy on an asset, the debtor can make a claim of exemption that this property shouldn't be levied upon, and any third parties can make a third party claim of ownership. And so the son would have to come forward, and the burden of proof is on the son to prove that he owns the property and that it was purchased for value, that he paid the real value to his father for that property.
Whereas if the creditor had filed an independent collection action, the creditor would have the burden of proof.
Exactly right.
That's very interesting, very, very useful nugget of information. Let's see. And one other to kind of bookend that question about something that civil attorneys should know. What is something that civil attorneys definitely should not try to do on their own without a judgment enforcement specialist?
You know, I think it's like anything. It depends on the practitioner. If you're used to getting out of your comfort zone, doing a lot of research, you can do just about anything. A good practice guide, a couple calls to your friend Joseph Chora, and away you go. The only thing I would absolutely suggest that you outsource is the asset investigation. The second and most important step is to make sure the guy you're chasing or the gal you're chasing has assets that you can eventually take and convert into money.
Yeah. Well, what about after the attorney has made a couple of calls for advice to his good friend Joseph Chora, and then kind of run into a brick wall. What is the brick wall that attorneys often run into and decide, you know what, this is too much research. I haven't spent this much time in the Rudder Guide since I was a first year associate. Joseph, can you take over X? What is X?
The one that scares most attorneys is levying upon a house, because everyone you talk to says it can't be done. It's never done. It's so complicated. It doesn't work. To find someone to tell you it's easy peasy, 1, 2, 3, I'll probably be the only person who tells you that.
Still, even in during the pandemic, with some of the measures that courts have put into place in terms of the pandemic.
Yeah, we took several houses during the pandemic. The hard part isn't taking the house. The hard part is getting the people out of the house.
Yeah.
Which, if you do it right, you sell the house to a third party. You've got the money. You don't care if the people get out of the house or not.
Wow. Okay. Tim, remind me never to cross this guy.
Okay. Let's get into still more, some nitty gritty questions about judgment enforcement. Let's start with an overview. Joseph, I wonder if you could kind of give us just a general outline overview of the judgment enforcement process. Maybe we start at you know, that maybe the moment the judgment is entered, I assume that's when the creditor starts looking at judgment enforcement options. And that's when the debtor and often me as the appellate attorney will say, well, you can appeal this, but you got to make sure that, you know, you're not going to lose your house and get your bank account wiped. Otherwise, how are you going to pay me for this all this great appellate work if the plaintiff is wiping your bank account? So maybe give us an overview of the process.
To all the trial attorneys out there, you know, before you file the lawsuit, you should know that the person has money to pay the amount that you want. You can conduct an asset investigation. It happens sometimes where I'll get a claim and I'll look at the debtor and he didn't hide his assets. He just never really had the assets. The second is the judgment facially valid? I would say one out of maybe 10, I look at the judgment and it can't be enforced the way it was written. And so we'll have to go back in and get it amended or interlineated or something just to get it fixed up.
Can you give an example of how a judgment can be facially invalid? I hadn't actually thought about that before.
Sure. It happens a lot. When we get to the third part where we're enforcing, we have to send instructions to the sheriff. And the sheriff is a stickler. They're not lawyers. They're not even clerks. But the names of the entities have to be described. It has to be ABC Inc., ABC LLC. If it's just ABC, you've got an unenforceable judgment.
Got it. And
that can really be an issue if there's a question. Sometimes these debtors will have entities with similar names and there's some confusion and it can be a problem.
Is that sort of thing happen with DBAs and other AKAs?
It does. Aliases. You know, sometimes women will get married and their last name will change. But those kind of AKAs, aliases, and when names change for marriage, those are relatively easy fixes where the judgment doesn't have to be amended. It's typically business entities where we find the most problems.
Okay. Anything else in the kind of the outline of judgment enforcement? What happens when judgment enforcement gets started? What typically do you see at that point? Does the debtor decide, okay, well, it looks like now the rubber has hit the road and they're going to start enforcing. So maybe I better just write the check.
So, you know, after the review of the facially valid judgment, it's the asset investigation to find out what assets this debtor has and how is he holding them. And that kind of leads right into the next step, which is developing an enforcement plan, whether he's got money in an offshore trust, bank accounts, a business, you know, valuable art, whatever the asset is, that kind of sets the shape. And at this point, you'll also kind of get some information as to whether or not there's been transfers. And whether you want to, again, like we talked about before, levy on the asset, anticipating unwinding that transfer through the levy process. But you're right. Their first response is to run, hide, and delay.
Yeah. All right. Well, here is in one of my exposures to judgment enforcement and defense of judgment enforcement, I came across an important California Supreme Court case, Conservatorship of McQueen. It's a 2014 case. And what I learned from that case in representing an appellant defendant who had stayed judgment enforcement and was trying to minimize his exposure to attorney fees for judgment enforcement, McQueen says that the right to seek judgment enforcement fees is cut off if the judgment is fully satisfied. So what that means, I take it, is that if the plaintiff creditor has spent $100,000 on Joseph Chora to enforce the judgment, but the appellant defendant writes a check and fully satisfies the face amount of the judgment plus any interest accrued before Joseph Chora files his motion for judgment enforcement fees, then the right to judgment enforcement fees is cut off. Is that the gist of what McQueen says, Joseph?
That's exactly right. And I've seen it happen where I call it sloppy, but maybe inattention, where someone will be a little slow asking for fees. You can file a memorandum of cost after judgment at any interval. We typically do it around $5,000 or $6,000. So as we're generating fees, we're adding them to the judgment immediately. Again, $5,000 is just enough that it's low enough that they're not going to want to pay their attorney to fight it. And even if they do, we're going to win. And then we add our fees for fighting it onto the judgment as well. And so you teach the judgment debtor right away, don't fight my fees. And that's more pressure to settle.
Got it. So you don't have to file a full-fledged motion for judgment enforcement fees. You can just kind of keep putting these bookmarks in by way of memoranda.
Exactly right.
And by picking small amounts, maybe the other side wouldn't go through the bother of filing a motion to tax or strike or whatever the opposition is. Interesting.
Exactly right.
Yeah. Well, that's a good tip. One of the exceptions to McQueen, again, McQueen says that that the debtor can cut off the right to judgment enforcement fees by fully satisfying the judgment before the creditor formally requests the enforcement fees. The exception to that is that to satisfy the judgment, it has to be not only paid or not only tendered, but paid and received. So a check or even a cashier's check doesn't work if the creditor, because the creditor can simply hold on to the check and not cash it until the creditor has filed the enforcement, the fee motion. So the exception, or to really make the remedy of McQueen work, the debtor has to pay the creditor in cash. Is that right, Joseph?
I'll tell you, my experience has been not as technical. I know that's what the case says. But as we all know, judges will do whatever they want, whenever they want, let them be appealed. Typically, what I've seen is that there's an understanding when counsel has been presented with the law, as long as there's receipt. Once you receive the check, I suppose a cashier's check would make a stronger case, cash an even stronger case. But yes, cash is what's required, but there's some wiggle room, and maybe that's honor among attorneys. And, you know, sometimes attorneys don't necessarily have that honorable stance.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. My experience with that, I once tried to make use of McQueen and had my client, the debtor had paid had fully satisfied the judgment by paying in cash quite a large sum of money in order to cut off judgment enforcement fees. And we cited McQueen to the trial court, but the trial court still granted the later filed motion for enforcement fees. So I was very frustrated that McQueen was not given force and effect in my experience. And then I'll just bookmark a couple of other cases for the audience here. We don't have to go into detail here, but just to kind of underscore what you just said, Joseph, that your mileage may vary. So there's a case, Gray 1 CPB versus SCC Acquisitions, a 2015 Court of Appeal decision that held that if a judgment were not fully satisfied because of the existence of as yet unawarded attorney fees, the phrase "before the judgment is fully satisfied" would serve no purpose, which is basically confirming what we had just been talking about in McQueen. It held to a kind of a literal reading of McQueen. But another court of appeal out of the Second District went a different direction last year in Wertheim LLC versus Currency Corp, where it held that additional fees were potentially awardable pursuant to the creditor's motion for them, because that right had been revived by a previous appeal. So even though that motion had been filed after the judgment was fully satisfied, the court said, well, but the payment in full satisfaction of the judgment wasn't conditioned on it being accepted as full satisfaction. So we're going to let the creditor file and potentially receive fees for enforcement even after satisfaction of the judgment. So it kind of undermined the holding of McQueen, and as confirmed by Gray 1 CPB. And I wonder, Joseph, if you know, is there any requirement that the defendant, when the defendant or debtor pays the judgment in full satisfaction, that does the debtor have to indicate on the form of payment that it's being made on the condition that it be accepted as full satisfaction?
Well, I'll tell you, there is no condition, but every time we get right up to the end, there's always a question to the penny, how much is owed? And you'd be surprised how difficult the accounting can be. And the smart lawyers will overpay, because then there's no question that it's been paid. Because if you're one penny short, you leave the door open.
I have noticed that it can be difficult to calculate it. I myself will do it multiple times and kind of do it different ways. And then opposing counsel will still have something that's just a little bit different. It always gives me heartburn. So I agree with what you say about, you know, maybe just write, how much over should you write the check?
Again, it's rare that I've never paid a judgment, but I'll tell you, the attorneys who have circumvented the issue have paid about over $1,000 over, just to make sure that it's done. And of course, a scrupulous attorney will return what we feel they should be, what they should receive.
Got it. Okay. I wanted to ask you also about trust and probate judgments. In my experience, they have not been subject to the enforcement of judgments law, the EJL. What do you say? Are judgments against a trust, an irrevocable trust after the settlor has passed away, can they be subject to the EJL, or are they purely creatures of the trial of the probate judge's discretion?
So it's been my experience that if you want to bust a trust or reach into the assets that are due to a third party, like a beneficiary, then you need to go into probate. But if the trustee on behalf of the trust is a judgment debtor, we have seized trust property.
Is there a way of doing that? Will the trustee say, no, you have to file a creditor claim? Even judgments are just mere claims against the trust, and they have to be brought by way of a creditor claim.
So what I can tell you, what we've done, and I tell my employees this all the time, just because it worked doesn't mean you did it right. If we had a judgment against a trust and we levied on trust bank account, and the money was seized and it was sent to the sheriff, and the trustee and the beneficiaries had an opportunity to file claims of exemption or third party claims, they didn't, and the money was released to us. Hmm. Game over. Once it's released, there's pretty much no going back.
Got it. So even if it's done, not done completely right, once the money's released, it's pretty much a done deal. You kind of get back into that principle of possession is 9/10.
There is strong law that once the gavel falls and the auction or turnover by the sheriff is complete, it's very rare to have that undone.
So with that in mind, would you suggest if you were approached by the creditor with a judgment against a trust where the settlor had passed away and the trust is under administration of the probate court, would you suggest taking a stab at using the enforcement of judgments law and just living upon assets that way before resorting to the creditor claim process?
Say that again, because I think this is a different set of facts.
Well, let's say you have a judgment against a trustee, the settlor has passed away, so the trust is being administered by the probate court.
So was the judgment against the person who, the decedent, or it's against the
successor,
trust?
Successor trustee. So at this point, it's against the trust or the trustee, but it's the successor. It's not the original settlor. It's because it's an irrevocable trust now because the settlor has passed away. So this is the point at which if you have a claim against the trust, any creditor ordinarily needs to file a creditor claim. You can't file a lawsuit against the deceased settlor. They need to file a creditor claim, and they would get meted out that way in the probate court. And I've seen this in the context where the successor trustee is in litigation following the death of the settlor, and there are claims and cross claims, and a judgment's entered against the successor trustee, but the judgment creditor can't get any satisfaction, can't enforce that judgment because the probate court says no, you can only seek satisfaction by way of filing a creditor claim.
I'd have to look at it, but my first instinct would be to move forward through the standard enforcement process
until someone tells you no, huh?
Exactly right.
Yeah, that was. I had a miserable experience in that case. And just to finish that story, we did file the creditor claim. The trustee basically pocketed it and didn't do anything with it. And so we filed a petition to enforce the creditor claim. And then the probate judge basically pocketed it, never set it for hearing. And so there we sat for a better part of 8 years. Meanwhile, the trustee continues to litigate, paying her own attorneys, of course, while we can't get any satisfaction on our attorney fee judgment against the trustee. It made me think that the EJL probably should apply against trusts. Let's see. We also discussed a case recently in which a plaintiff and a defendant agreed to use a general verdict form. They were kind of brokering about whether to use general or specific verdict forms. And they agreed to use a general verdict form in exchange for a stipulation to limit judgment enforcement. It would be limited to just collecting against the insurance policy and indemnity duties. I wonder if you had ever seen this sort of thing. And it seemed very creative solution. And I just wondered, gosh, does a stipulation like that hold up by the time you get a judgment? Can your rights to enforce a judgment under the full panoply of enforcement methods under the EJL be limited by pre-judgment stipulations?
It certainly can. There's case law that a judgment is a contract, And if you get into that frame of mind, you can craft it any way you like. You know, we talked about invalid judgments earlier with the wrong parties. You can definitely limit and shape how a judgment comes out.
Now, would you have to incorporate that stipulation into the face of the judgment?
Absolutely. There's a doctrine, the merger doctrine, that says all claims are merged into that piece of paper. And so, you know, every time I talk to a trial attorney, this is another nugget. All your work, all your depositions, all that discovery, all that trial prep, everything comes down to that piece of paper. If it's not on the piece of paper, it's not there.
Yeah. So if you forget to put that in your proposed form of judgment and the judge just signs it without that, without any evidence of that stipulation being in the form of judgment, then you're out of luck. That stipulation, for all intents and purposes, does not exist, I take it, correct?
Yeah, there was a case that we had, and it was a while ago, and we litigated it post-judgment, but attorney's fees were awarded, but did not show up on the face of the judgment. And so we ended up not being able to get attorney's fees for enforcement.
Wow. All right, let's move on. I wanted to ask you a little bit about alter ego judgments. Now, most attorneys know that they have the option whenever they are suing a defendant and they think that there are or may be alter egos that they can get liability attached to, they have the option to either allege those alter egos in the complaint and go forward with discovery against those alter egos and prove the alter ego at trial, or they can just ignore all those alter egos, get the judgment against the primary defendant, and then seek alter ego liability afterward, after entry of the judgment, in a Code of Civil Procedure Section 187 motion. And I wonder, Joseph, what do you think attorneys ought to know when considering these two routes?
So we just had a case that we dealt with on this where the plaintiff waited too long in the trial cycle and it was too close to trial. And the judge said, yeah, you know what? I think he is an alter ego, but I'm not going to let you add him because you're going to disrupt my docket. Too bad.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have what you need to make that person an alter ego, do it sooner than later. It's better to do it before entry of judgment, because then even if you fail, we still have post-judgment for a second swing.
Got it. What about trying to add an alter ego after the entry of judgment, where that alter ego individual did not appear, was not a participant in the lawsuit? Are litigants, are plaintiffs still able to add those kinds of non-appearing alter egos after the entry of the judgment?
So there's a lot of nuance in that area. In order to find an alter ego, you need to have a unity of interest. Unjust result will occur if the corporate entity or the non-alter ego is respected. And finally, the proposed alter ego has to have had their due process rights protected by participation, even if only vicariously, in the underlying litigation. So there's a lot of analysis that would go into that.
Right. So it might be a different analysis if the lead defendant is the individual who's already participating in the trial, and you're just thinking about maybe adding other partnerships or maybe a trustee capacity or, you know, LLCs that may be potential alter egos. You could maybe leave those for after the entry of the judgment, but you can't proceed against the LLC, for example, as the lead defendant and then count on later adding the individual members as alter egos under CCP 187.
You could if the member or members were virtually represented by control of the LLC.
You'd have to establish that they controlled the litigation.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
And the due process is that their due process rights were protected. They were virtually represented in the lawsuit.
Okay. All right. Next subject. Now here, I thought maybe you could settle a dispute between Jeff and me about anti-SLAPP fee awards. Now, as the audience may know, I've taken the position that I published in an article in California Litigation Magazine last month that anti-SLAPP fee awards are automatically stayed on appeal, even without the need to post a bond. That's because under the 1992 legislative amendments, there's no longer the routine versus non-routine cost distinction. So SLAPP fee awards are treated just like any other kind of fee awards or costs, which are automatically stayed. There is a little bit of an older case, and that's confirmed in the Quiles decision, Quiles versus Parent. There's a slightly older appellate decision in Dowling that says SLAPP fees are non-routine costs, so they're more like they're more like money judgments. They're not automatically stayed without without the appeal, not automatically stayed without a bond. And I wonder if you settle that bet. Are they automatically stayed or not?
Jeff, did you want to be heard before I?
Well, I was going to bring a motion that grossly misstates the holding of Dowling. Dowling, the court said that it was the intent of the legislature to deter frivolous slap lawsuit, and that by not recognizing an automatic stay, they were furthering the legislative intent in protecting litigants from slaps. That was my reading of Dowling. But go ahead.
Well, that sounds like the Dowling court was making a very impassioned a campaign statement to join the legislature and to rewrite that statute.
So we use anti-slap quite a bit. Oftentimes, judgment debtors will feel the pressure of our enforcement and they'll want to hit back. And so we get sued on a regular basis, and we're constantly anti-slapping, picking up fees and then applying additional pressure. My law partner does the majority of the anti-slap work, and I had to phone a friend this morning to get his take on it. We had a good discussion about it, and the winner is Jeff.
Your partner's brilliant.
They're not stayed. They are not routine costs. That analysis is still good.
All right. Well, there are two different Court of Appeal decisions on that, standing for either proposition. So whatever side of that issue you find yourself on, there is a Court of Appeal decision that meets your needs, and you can cite either one of them, and a trial court is free to accept either one that the court happens to feel is more persuasive. All right, let's see. I wanted to move on the related issue of bonds and stays. I wondered, I think you mentioned that issue comes up sometimes in your practice of judgment enforcement. Do you get involved in litigation over appellate stays of enforcement?
We do. That typically comes up. We have started to develop an appellate practice as part of our judgment enforcement. We'll do a little bit of pre-litigation or pre-judgment, bankruptcy, appellate work, a little bit of probate. But again, it's all focused on the judgment. So those stay motions, you know, again, they'll cite that it doesn't have to be stayed, whether it's anti-slap or just in general. But we do some of that work.
Let's see. Have you ever seen? Go ahead, Jeff.
I was just going to ask. So let me ask you, if there's a case where you've got a judgment and you're doing judgment enforcement and the other side appeals, and let's say they post an adequate bond, there's no dispute over the amount of the bond or the adequacy of the collateral or whatever. Do you then cool your jets for 2 years while the appeal winds its way through? Or is there anything you do during the 2 years on behalf of creditors while the case is up on appeal?
There really isn't anything that we can do. You know, I'm sure you're aware it's 150% for accredited, and unaccredited is 200%. All we do is we kind of bookmark and manage to make sure that should we win the appeal, that the money's there. If there's some change for whatever reason, if the appeal becomes crazy expensive, then, you know, we would go in, you know, fight about the adequacy. But other than that, no, we absolutely cool our jets.
Okay. Interesting.
What if the amount of the judgment changes, such as by a subsequent a post-judgment award of attorney's fees and costs? At that point, that gets added to the amount of the judgment by operation of statute. Do you ever advise your clients to go in on a motion to increase the amount of the bond?
We've done it several times for just that kind of thing, where there will be something pending and they'll post a bond, whether it's adequate at that moment or it's slightly inadequate. And then when the attorney's fees come in, it is then inadequate. Yes, we will go in and object to the sufficiency of the bond.
Is that a useful leverage point, or is it more just because you want to make sure your client is fully protected?
It's a protection thing. And unfortunately, some of these attorneys are short-sighted in that they want to fight about the amount of the bond and will spend $20,000 fighting about the bond. And so they'll then be right minus the 20, and then we'll fight again and it'll go up another 20, and they're always $20,000 behind, and we'll go in 3 or 4 times before they figure it out.
And you're adding the enforcement fees on top of everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. The first rule of holes for debtors is to put the shovel down and stop digging when you find yourself in a hole. And rarely do they follow that rule.
All right. And Jeff and I have, we're both still looking for someone who has ever seen a personal surety bond. Have you ever encountered one of these personal surety bonds? Now, everyone knows about if you want to stay a judgment on appeal, you have to post a surety bond, but it's an admitted surety bond. It has to be one of the sureties that's acknowledged by the California Insurance Commissioner, I think. But you can you could post a personal surety bond, basically just another person who's willing to vouch for you. It has to be in, I think, four times the amount of the judgment at that point.
Yeah.
Never seen that, I take it, huh, Joseph?
No. But you know what? There is an organization of judgment enforcers. I'm going to put that out. I'm gonna see if I can find one for you.
Okay. That'd be interesting. I did read one real interesting case that's always stuck in my head. The name of it is, I don't know how to pronounce it, Buzgia. And the issue was it involved a personal surety bond. The debtor had transferred assets to his wife, who went and posted the personal surety bond. And the creditor said, but that's a fraudulent transfer. And the judge said, no, it wasn't. It was made for the benefit of the creditor because that bond is in the benefit. It's now held, you know, those assets are now held by the wife, who is now essentially a co-judgment debtor by virtue of that personal surety bond. So it didn't transfer it out of the hands of away from the reach of the creditor. So it was that was all fair.
That sounds like the right decision.
But still, I've never seen one of these creatures, only heard about them. And they seem enticing, but no takers so far. I had another question about, now we're getting to the end of the process of the appeal. Let's say that the appellant obtains reversal of the judgment against him. But the appellant had made some partial satisfaction, had paid some amount of the judgment along the way. So now the formerly prevailing plaintiff is liable to return all that partial satisfaction he had received on the judgment. And not only that, but full restitution as well, including interest and even lost business profits. That was a case we saw last year in Dr. Leeville LLC versus Westlake Healthcare. As I recall, in that case, it involved an eviction of a business from a building. And the tenant appealed the order. In the meantime, the landlord went and sold the building. Maybe didn't sell the building, but evicted the plaintiff and the tenant. The tenant lost the business, and there was some $1 million in lost profits that I think nearly was awarded, or I think maybe it was left unsettled. But the upshot was that the formerly prevailing plaintiff may be liable for lost business profits if their former judgment is reversed. And I wondered if that sort of risk ever comes into your thinking when advising whether to go forward with enforcing a judgment.
Absolutely. You know, we talked about debtors running into bankruptcy and the appellate court. And so if the debtor appeals, we want to know what's the likelihood that this is going to be overturned. And the creditor needs to know that if that happens, there's a good chance that you're going to be responsible for returning that money that we've paid out to you.
Yeah, better invest it with a good, better than 10% return.
Is it a good idea for the creditor to kind of once having recovered either part or all of the judgment, is it good to sit on it until the resolution of the appeal?
You know, that's the recommendation that we make to clients. One of the strategies that we employ is the disentitlement doctrine. Oftentimes, again, people who have money don't want to pay, and so they will fraudulently transfer, they won't provide documents, they won't sit for examinations, they'll engage in obstructive litigation tactics. And we've brought a couple successful, and we have one pending right now, disentitlement motion to dismiss the appeal without reaching the merits. And so if our appellate standing isn't that great, an alternative is the disentitlement doctrine.
Yeah, that's a great tip. How egregious do the debtor's evasions need to be in order to kind of meet that threshold for dismissal under the disentitlement doctrine?
So like most cases, it says contempt is not required, but contempt would work.
Right.
And contempt is relatively easy to show. I mean, you can get contempt for not complying with a subpoena, not appearing at a court-ordered debtor examination. That's a court order to appear, and you are in violation of that court order. Typically, for us, it's obstructive litigation tactics. It's a pattern of continually taking actions to disrupt, to hinder, delay, and defraud the creditor.
Is that an active strategy in some of your cases to to kind of check those boxes to see if you can satisfy the elements of a disentitlement motion?
Absolutely. So again, from the beginning of the case, we're thinking appeal. What are the merits of our appeal? Are we in a strong position? But at the same time, are they shooting themselves in the foot by opening themselves up to be dismissed on before they reach the merits?
That's I think that's a great tip. I love bringing disentitlement motions when they're justified. I think in the last year or so, Jeff, in the cases, I think both of us are always looking out for opinions that dismiss appeals on disentitlement grounds. It seems to be getting, at least from my eyes, it seemed to be getting a little bit harder to meet the standard for disentitlement. I wondered if that met with your experience, Joseph. Are they harder to achieve than they used to, dismissals on disentitlement grounds?
I'll be honest. I think we're at a total of 4 that we've done. So I don't have a tremendous amount of experience. But no, I don't find them any more difficult. That being said, the debtors that we deal with are the worst of the worst. They're the 1% that when you hear the facts, you're like, oh my God, why isn't this person in jail?
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So now to wrap all this up, we've talked about a lot of things relating to judgment enforcement, from the technical to gold nuggets of tips that attorneys, both trial and appellate attorneys, should employ. And I wonder, Jeff, if you can kind of, Joseph, if you could bring it full circle and tell us now, many attorneys will, as I mentioned earlier, we'll try to take some of these steps themselves to enforce a judgment or defend enforcement of judgment. What are some signals that attorneys should look out for, to read, to tell them that it might be time to bring in a judgment enforcement specialist at this point?
My advice is always the same. Call me early or call me late, but I'll be more effective if you call me early. Again, when you're thinking about filing a case, check to make sure he has the money. When you're getting ready to enter judgment, there are certain things you want to do immediately, right? Just from an appellate point of view, if you file a notice of ruling, you shorten their window to file an appeal. If you don't, they have 6 months. Little things like that you may not be thinking about. Preparation for bankruptcy. We prepare all our cases that they're going to go into bankruptcy. If you call me after they've gone into bankruptcy, I can still help, but not nearly as much if we prepared 6 months ago for them to go into bankruptcy. So early is better. Late, I might still be able to do something.
Yeah. Well, I've got a number of tips that I've written down that I plan to use in my own practice. I'm sure you have too, Jeff. I want to thank Joseph Chora for joining us on this episode. I think this has been enormously helpful for me at a minimum, and hopefully for the rest of our audience. And Jeff, I think that wraps us up this episode.
Yeah. First, I'm going to go tell my staff not to seize dogs as part of debtors' examinations. And we want to thank you for being here. And we want to thank Case Text for sponsoring our podcast. Each week, we include links to the cases we discuss using Case Text. And listeners of the podcast can find a 25% discount available to them if they sign up at casetext.com/calp. That's casetext.com/CALP.
And if you have suggestions for future episodes or topics that we should cover on future episodes of the podcast, please email either Jeff or me at info@calpodcast.com. And in our upcoming episodes, look for more tips on how to lay the groundwork for an appeal when preparing for trial.
See you next time.
You have just listened to the California Appellate Podcast, a discussion of timely trial tips and the latest cases and news coming from the California Court of Appeal and the California Supreme Court. For more information about the cases discussed in today's episode, our hosts, and other episodes, visit the California Appellate Law Podcast website at calpodcast.com. That's calpodcast.com. Thanks to Jonathan Caro for our intro music. Thank you for listening, and please join us again